Trump wants more, Conyers wants off, temporarily, and feminists put the squeeze on Franken. No shutdown this week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Al Franken is contrite and apologetic. Is that enough? And does this remove him from the list of 2020 presidential hopefuls?
I think people are still reeling from what's happening in 2017. They can't really focus yet on 2020, but it'll be interesting to hear how Al Franken's image looks with a little more time and perspective.
Plus, Doug Jones decides to go after Roy Moore on the sexual accusations. Will it be enough to win?
Whether that turnout comes, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. But really, Jones needs that December 12th electorate to be 25% African-American if he's going to have any chance of winning.
And we go back 50 years to recall Eugene McCarthy's startling challenge to a sitting president.
My decision to challenge the president's position has been strengthened by recent announcements out of the administration. The evident intention to escalate and to intensify the war in Vietnam.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and link to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge. Because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us and welcome to episode 207 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Well, there's not too much evidence this week of adult or responsible behavior coming out of the White House. The president making up reasons why he won't be Time Magazine's Person of the Year. Or him questioning whether the voice on that infamous Access Hollywood groping tape was really his. Or retweeting three anti-Muslim videos posted by a British far-right group. Or saying we should give Roy Moore the benefit of the doubt because he's innocent, while at the same time congratulating all the women who were speaking out against sexual harassment and Al Franken. But the lowest of the low had to be the event in the Oval Office on Monday, when the president honored three Navajo Code Talker veterans of World War II. Trump started off seemingly fine, but apparently couldn't help himself from going off script.
I just want to thank you because you're very, very special people. You were here long before any of us were here, although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you.
Just in case you missed that, the President of the United States, at a solemn ceremony honoring three Native Americans, used a term seen by many Indians as a slur. Of course, his Pocahontas reference was to Senator Elizabeth Warren, a frequent Trump target, who has been mocked for years by Republicans for identifying herself as part Native American during her academic career. What made the event even worse is that it took place in front of a portrait of President Andrew Jackson, who signed the Indian Removal Act of 1830 that led to the displacement and deaths of many Native Americans. When reporters asked White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders why the president would use a racial slur at the ceremony, she took umbrage.
At the event that the president just did with the Navajo Code Talkers, he referred to Pocahontas being in the Senate. Why did he feel the need to say something that is offensive to many people while honoring the Navajo Code Talkers, these genuine American
heroes? I think what most people find offensive is Senator Warren lying about her heritage to advance her career.
She said it was a racial slur. What is your response to that?
I think that's a ridiculous response.
This was all too much for Senator Warren, who said this on Bloomberg.
It's an honoring ceremony, and that Donald Trump has to get in a racist slur is truly disgusting. Now, look, he's going to keep doing this. He thinks somehow it's going to make me shut up. It hasn't worked in the past, not going to work in the future.
A very disheartening set of events. Anyway, all of this leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last Native American to be part of a major party presidential ticket? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com will select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
They killed us in our TV, and they cut our women down. They might have left some babies crying on the ground. But the fire stills, and the wagons come. And the night falls on the setting.
The list of powerful men who have been accused of sexual impropriety has extended to Capitol Hill, and it includes some who have long been considered strong supporters of women and women's rights. Representative John Conyers, the Democrat from Michigan who is the longest-serving member of Congress, has been accused by two former aides of sexual harassment. He even paid a settlement to one of the women, and there have been calls for him to resign. Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, offered up this awkward defense of Conyers Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press.
Just because someone is accused, and was it one accusation, is it two? I think there has to be. John Conyers is an icon in our country. He has done a great deal to protect women, Violence Against Women Act, which the left wing, right wing is now quoting me as praising him for his work on that, and he did great work on that.
Pelosi got slammed by many feminists for that. But in the days since, the New York Times has reported that she's working with members of the Congressional Black Caucus to persuade Conyers to leave. But what to do about Al Franken? Franken, the Democratic senator from Minnesota, has been accused by one woman of kissing her against her will, and by three others who say Franken grabbed their behinds while their pictures were being taken with him. The accusations against Franken have resulted in mixed responses from feminists in the state and around the country. They have been outraged over charges of sexual molestation of teenagers against Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, and they remain furious about the history of alleged sexual misconduct by President Trump, who infamously talked about groping women following the release last year of that Access Hollywood tape. But Al Franken? Some feminists say that what he's accused of is not comparable to the allegations against Roy Moore. They argue that in his nearly 8 years in the Senate, he's been a steadfast supporter of women's issues. But others say that's not the point. Just because he votes a certain way shouldn't give him a pass to act boorishly. Some call for his resignation. Franken himself sounded quite contrite this week as he returned to the Senate for the first time since the story broke.
I know that I've let a lot of people down, people of Minnesota. My colleagues, my staff, my supporters, and everyone who has counted on me to be a champion for women. To all of you, I just want to again say I am sorry. I know there are no magic words that I can say to regain your trust, and I know that's going to take time. I'm ready to start that process, and it starts with going back to work today.
He said he would not resign, but would cooperate with the Senate Ethics Committee in its investigation. He said he was ashamed and embarrassed over the charges. But he also said that his understanding of the events in question either differed from what the women said, or that he had no memory of them ever happening. Jennifer Brooks is a reporter with the Minneapolis Star Tribune and has been covering this story. Jennifer, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you've heard at least three apologies from Franken this week. One was on Minnesota Public Radio, one was on Minneapolis's WCCO, and now last Monday in front of his Senate office in Washington. What did you come away with in what he had to say?
Well, he's been remarkably consistent in his messaging. Every single outlet he talked to, every single microphone he talks into, he repeats the same things over and over again. He is very, very, very sorry for what he did, which is not necessarily what the women said he did, because we can't quite get clarity from him about whether, you know, he has put his hands on women's backsides. But he's threading a really fine needle. He says we should believe the women, but he believes them without necessarily agreeing with their accounts of what happened. So that's an interesting take.
I was on Minnesota Public Radio on Monday, and the callers, they were mostly women, but the callers were split. Half said he apologized and it's time to move on. Half said a statement that he didn't remember squeezing their behinds was just not believable. So are you hearing from people back home, and what are they saying? Is it any different than what I heard?
I'm hearing quite a few opinions strongly expressed, and it's divided equally between people who think I'm being too hard on him and people who think I'm not being hard enough on him. But while he's back to work now, he just asked some hard questions of Supreme Court Justice David Strauss at his confirmation hearing. So he's trying to get back to work as normal. You know, it's a long time between now and his next election, and although he's called for a Senate ethics investigation into his behavior, it's been an even longer time since the Senate Ethics Committee has issued more than a slap on the wrist to one of its own members.
Although you can go back, I mean, I guess you're going back quite a bit, but I guess if you have John Ensign of Nevada, and in the mid-90s you had Bob Packwood of Oregon, both resigned before any kind of Senate action. But speaking of resigning, I mean, have you heard many calls for him to resign? I saw that two Democratic candidates who are running for governor of Minnesota next year said he should quit, but I haven't heard many Democrats calling for that result.
Not many. I think most of his allies are pretty torn about this because, as you pointed out, he has been a very forceful voice for women's issues. He was cheering on the Me Too movement right up until the time he got named by somebody with the Me Too hashtag. So I think a lot of them are waiting to see if this is the end of the allegations. If it does come to this, they might move on to more problematic targets. But in the current news cycle, it never seems to stop.
I mean, I remember back in 2008, one of the issues the Republicans tried to use against him was his history of jokes, and I put jokes in quotation marks. You know, back when he was a comedian appearing on Saturday Night Live, he would make jokes about rape and lesbians, and I mean, not that rape is ever a funny topic, but the Republicans made sure to remind people of that history last week.
Yeah, the bestiality jokes, the whole gamut. He has gone through the fire once before in 2008. When a lot of people wanted him to resign or at least step aside and let someone with, you know, fewer bestiality jokes on their resume run for the Senate. And he weathered that just fine. And I think he is hoping that he'll be able to ride this one out one more time. So we'll see.
Well, he doesn't have to face the voters again until 2020. And is it fair to say that it's probably too soon to tell whether this has hurt him with the voters in Minnesota?
Yeah, well, I think we can definitely say he's hurting in the short term. His standing both in Minnesota and on the national level, he was a rising star in the Democratic Party. He was named as he was on the list of all the 2020 presidential hopefuls. Of course, half the people in the Senate are on that list. But, you know, he was a fundraising powerhouse. He could draw crowds anywhere in the country, and it's going to be a while before anyone's going to be really comfortable having Al Franken's name, you know, a dinner invite at their fundraiser in Iowa or, you know, maybe even Minnesota.
Have you heard from Democrats and Democratic activists saying that 2020 is no longer a realistic probability?
I think people are still reeling so much from what's happening in 2017, they can't really focus yet on 2020. But in the days and the weeks to come, it'll be interesting to hear how this shakes out, how Al Franken's image looks with a little more time and perspective.
What about those people who say that in this era of sexual harassment, whatever that means, that it's not fair to lump Franken together with Roy Moore or Donald Trump or even Harvey Weinstein, you know, those who have shown a history of unacceptable behavior towards women?
Yeah, I've heard that quite a bit. And, you know, it's a question. It's just I'm not sure who gets to draw that line. I think if you are going to believe the women, you need to take pretty seriously when a woman says, I was forcibly kissed by the senator, a person I admired, and I wanted to get my picture taken with him. He reached down and, you know, next thing I know, his hand was cupping my buttocks. If a woman says that, I think it's hard to say to that woman, well, yeah, that's bad, but it wasn't that bad. You know, it seems like I certainly wouldn't feel comfortable dismissing someone else's feelings like that. If any good is to come out of all of this mess, maybe it's to remind everybody to maybe treat each other with a little bit of respect.
Jennifer Brooks is a political reporter with the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Jennifer, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks.
We're now less than 2 weeks to go before Alabama's special Senate election, one of the most bizarre Senate races we've seen in quite some time. There are questions about ideology. Is Democrat Doug Jones too liberal for Alabama? Will his victory imperil the GOP majority? Things like that. But there are also questions about personal conduct. Did Republican Roy Moore molest a teenage girl decades ago when he was a 30-something district attorney? Are all the women who have come forward to accuse Moore of sexual impropriety over the years telling the truth? Or are they, as the Moore campaign and one guy in the White House contend, part of a liberal media plot to stop him? The big news of the past week is the kinda, sorta endorsement of Moore by President Trump. He was asked about the Senate race by reporters as he was leaving the White House for Thanksgiving in Florida with helicopters blaring in the background.
I can tell you one thing for sure. We don't need a liberal person in there, a Democrat, Jones. I've looked at his record. It's terrible in crime. It's terrible in the border. It's terrible in the military. I can tell you for a fact, we do not need somebody that's going to be bad on crime, bad on borders, bad with the military, bad for the Second Amendment.
But when asked about the accusations against Moore, the president said this.
Well, he denies it. Look, he denies it. I mean, if you look at what is really going on, and you look at all the things that have happened over the last 48 hours, he totally denies it. He says it didn't happen, and, you know, you have to listen to him also.
Brian Lyman covers state government for the Montgomery Advertiser and joins us now. Brian, it's great having you back on The Political Junkie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you know, given the fact that Trump once backed the wrong horse in this race, he supported Luther Strange over Moore in the Republican primary, how significant is it that Trump seems to be rooting for a Moore victory, even if Republicans in Washington clearly are not?
You know, it's so hard to say because Roy Moore is such a uniquely Alabama phenomenon and creation. You know, you obviously saw Trump threw his entire weight behind Luther Strange, who raised much more money than Roy Moore did in the primary and in the runoff. And in the end, it was Moore's loyal base that ultimately took him over the top. You know, we can't ignore the national dimensions of this race. I mean, they're clearly out there. But almost every race that Roy Moore runs in Alabama becomes a referendum on Roy Moore. And I think that's what's going to happen. You know, if Trump, yeah, I don't think Trump's endorsement hurts Moore at all. But at the same time, I really think it just adds to the, you know, just basically the situation of Alabama deciding whether they want to be represented by Moore in the U.S. Senate.
And do the voters know that the Republicans may ultimately vote to expel him should he win on December 12th?
Obviously, people have heard that talk. I think a lot of people, though, find it implausible. And the other thing, too, to consider is that if Moore was expelled, he could come back and run again in a makeup election. And I'm sure his base would be even more fired up to vote for him in that situation than they would be now.
Doug Jones is the Democrat in this race. And, of course, he was long thought. When you were on the show a bunch of weeks ago, I mean, he was such an afterthought to all of this. But it seemed like at first he wanted to avoid the Moore sex scandal story, but his latest ads show a change in strategy.
On Roy Moore's disturbing actions, Ivanka Trump says there's a special place in hell for people who prey on children. And I have no reason to doubt the victims' accounts. Jeff Sessions says, I have no reason to doubt these young women. And Richard Shelby says he will absolutely not vote for Roy Moore. Conservative voices, putting children and women over party, doing what's right.
And for his part, Moore refuses to back down.
I want to join with Donald Trump. Make America great again. And I know to be great again, we've got to be good again. To be good again, we have to talk about something that politicians don't talk about, and that's morality, the definition of right and wrong. There is only one source in this country, and that's God. If there is no God, then it's about the majority of people on the United States Supreme Court. And we've got to stop that because that's not what this country is founded upon.
Brian, aside from the great irony of Roy Moore talking about morality playing a role in this race, are the campaigns making a difference? I mean, or do you think the voters have already made up their minds?
With the caveat that we will know this for certain on December 12th, I do think, you know, the Jones campaign is acting as if suburban women are still very much in play. And in Alabama, that's usually a good bet when Roy Moore runs, because Moore tends to underperform in general elections, typically because he underperforms with female voters. So, you know, like that ad, for instance, that you just played, I mean, like that's clearly a play to your suburban women who want to vote. So, like in that sense, I think that's probably the most critical thing about this. The other thing I might mention, though, is that since the allegations have surfaced, you've really seen two very starkly different campaigns. Jones has been in public. He's traveled all over the state. I mean, he was in Hale County Sunday. He was in Tuscaloosa earlier this week. He's been up to Huntsville. You know, he's been all the way down to Mobile. I mean, he's been traveling all over the state. Moore has gone to ground, basically, since these allegations came out. He started reappearing this week, but, you know, he was in rural DeKalb County, which is far away from most media markets. He's supposed to be in Mobile on Wednesday. Yeah, you're really seeing, like, one candidate who's really going out to, like, really trying to meet the voters and try to, you know, make his pitch to them. And then you have another who's basically, you know, basically just hoping that the people who know who he is and really admire him will come out to the polls for him, you know, like without him really having to go out very much and face some uncomfortable questions about the allegations he faces.
Well, one of the keys to a Jones victory, everybody seems to think, is a big African-American turnout. Do you see any indication that that might happen?
You know, I just published a story about this on the Montgomery Advertiser, and it's very hard to say. You can look at the August 15th primary where, for instance, like the total number of Democratic votes for every candidate in that primary, including Jones, the combined total was only slightly higher than the votes Moore alone got in that primary. But if you look at counties that were, you know, like where the African American population is 40% or higher, turnout in those counties was overall slightly higher than the state as a whole. And I've spoken with voters, I've spoken with, you know, organizations working on this, and for, like, some younger Black voters I spoke with, the race seems to be going over their heads. In Hale County, when I spoke with activists, everyone seemed to be engaged in that. I mean, like, I think, you know, if you speak with individual voters, they'll all tell you individual stories. You know, I can tell you, you know, Jones is certainly trying to get the Black vote out. Like, on Sunday, he was at, I think, 6 Black churches in Jefferson County, and he did this event in Hale County. He's made numerous trips to Montgomery County, which is majority Black. Whether that turnout comes, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. But, I mean, really, Jones needs that December 12th electorate to be 25% African-American if he's going to have any chance of winning.
And Jones is also outspending Moore pretty drastically, is my understanding. But Moore was also vastly outspent during the primary, and he won that too. So is money going to play a big difference in the final 2 weeks?
Moore is almost always outspent in races, and he does very little television, and chiefly the reason is he doesn't need to. He's got a large and loyal base who will come out for him no matter what. In many cases, he just simply needs to show up because his folks will follow him no matter what. Jones has the trickier problem because he not only had to introduce himself to the state electorate, and I think he's done that, he also has to put together a coalition that really has not existed in Alabama for some years. He's got to get Black voters, he has
has to get, he really has to get women voters, just basically, you know, like especially suburban women voters. And sometimes what might play well to one group will not play well with the other. So it's a very delicate balance. And, you know, it's something that's very difficult that could easily get upset if you're not too careful.
You know, I've asked you a lot of questions today that are almost impossible to answer. And I understand that completely. But I also know that the polls are all over the map as well. There are some polls that show Jones up, some that are more up. Just from your reporting, what are you hearing? Do you have a gut sense of any of this?
The best thing I can say is that Jones has had, I mean, if you told me in August what Jones needed to do, I mean, I would say, you know, he needed to, you know, like get on TV. He needed to, you know, really try and turn out the cities, and then he would need something outside to happen. And, you know, all of that has happened to this point. So Jones is getting every opportunity he needs to make his case. We just, like, we'll just have to see if he can persuade voters on enough voters on December 12th to go with him.
Brian Lyman is covering the Alabama Senate race for the Montgomery Advertiser. Brian, thanks so much for being on the program.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There's no way of knowing how Donald Trump, whose 1 year in office has thus far been filled with controversy and vitriol, will fare with historians. Another president with his share of controversy, and certainly no shortage of opponents, was Franklin D. Roosevelt. Elected 4 times, he may have done more to transform government than any chief executive in history. And he's the subject of a great new biography, Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life, by Robert Dalek. How Dalek managed to fit everything into one tidy volume is beyond me, but he did, and he's here to talk about it. Robert Dalek, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you.
So much of what I read that it shows that a president can make controversial decisions while at the same time working to solve the problems and try to unite the country.
Yep, he was quite extraordinary in that way. And, you know, Ken, the important thing at the start of his presidency was to give the country some hope, because it was in a miserable shape. 25% unemployment and people in lines buying apples at 5 cents a pop, and a million people riding the rails around the country in search of some work or some kind of place to call home. And he came to the office, and Walter Lippmann, the great journalist, when Roosevelt gave his inaugural speech and then gave a fireside chat, which became a hallmark of his administration, overnight he generated hope, because people had been so demoralized by that Hoover administration. And somebody said to Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover's a very good act to follow. And it was indeed. But Roosevelt generated hope.
As you were talking about the situation, about the millions of people out of work and things like that, it reminded me, I mean, how many times, and I'm going to play a piece of tape now, but how many times have we heard President Trump say this?
To be honest, I inherited a mess. It's a mess.
I mean, I think it would be fair to say that FDR inherited a mess as well, maybe more so.
Well, absolutely. It was the worst mess since Abraham Lincoln confronted the departure of the Confederate States with the potential breakup of the Union, and then, of course, the Civil War.
He saw hope when not many others did. But I guess, Robert, I think the question you answer in your great book is that, was he confident that he had the answers?
You know, Ken, he wasn't sure what was going to revive the economy. And in fact, the truth be told, it wasn't the New Deal that got the country firmly out of the Depression. It was industrial mobilization beginning in 1939, 1940. But what he did was something more important. He humanized the American industrial system by putting into place things like unemployment insurance, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which insured guaranteed bank accounts, housing legislation, farm legislation that saved people from the loss of their lifetime properties, and putting into place Social Security, the hours and wages bill, minimum wages and maximum hours. It was an extraordinary array of legislative achievements.
You know, you said a few minutes ago that the New Deal, the effects, the good effects of the New Deal really wasn't seen until 1930, 1940, as we were leading to war. We may not have known it was war, but whenever a president does whatever he has to do, and then, of course, he comes up for re-election 4 years later, in 1936, things were not better. In many ways, you could make the case that the situation was almost worse. And yet, when he went before the people, when Roosevelt went before the people in 1936, he won a resounding re-election victory.
Oh, he did. He won one of the greatest election victories in presidential history. Indeed, he won 46 out of 48 states. But the degree to which he had a hold on the public's imagination. In the Gallup polls, he never went below 50% approval in the 12-plus years he was in office. And into the bargain, Roosevelt's principal political advisor, Louis Howe, who died in 1937, but in 1935, he said to Eleanor Roosevelt, "Would you like to run for president in 1940 after Franklin steps aside?" And she said, "No, it's too soon. And besides, one politician in the family is enough." But it speaks volumes, I think, about this expert on public feeling, public mood in the country could imagine Eleanor Roosevelt running for the highest office in 1940.
Yeah, I was going to say, I can't imagine the wife of a president ever running for president herself. Wait a second.
Right.
I forgot what happened recently. You know, I think it's fair, and your book doesn't dissuade me from this at all, that to make the argument that he is among the three or four best presidents we ever had. But as your book fairly and clearly points out, he made mistakes along the way. What would you say were his most egregious mistakes?
Well, the court packing plan in 1937, which failed, the attempt to purge the party of its conservative elements in 1938. And I think, if the truth be told, if it weren't for the war, I don't think he ever would have had a third, and certainly not a fourth term, but the war made the difference. But you see, Ken, he understood that if you were going to get into a war that was going to cost the country significant blood and treasure, you needed to have a stable consensus. And the British ambassador in November of 1940 pressed him to ask Congress for a declaration of war. And he said, "We could get it. We could put that forward, and we could get a majority vote for it, but it wouldn't be sufficient, because at the first setback in the fighting, it would threaten the national consensus." And of course, it was Pearl Harbor that, in a way, was a godsend. That's why, in part, people thought that he knew the surprise was coming, because it did serve his purposes. But he was very shrewd about public opinion. You know, polling began in the mid-30s, but he didn't necessarily need polls to tell him what the country's mood was. He had all sorts of people going around the country reporting to him on what they found, what sentiment was like. And he knew he enjoyed considerable popularity, but that would be risked if he prematurely took the country into World War II. So he was brilliant at measuring public sentiment, and much the same in presiding over the shift from isolationism to internationalism at the end of World War II.
You know, Robert, you were talking earlier about how the war basically the lead up to the war and the fear of war helped him get reelected in 1940 and 1944. But you also, your book also talks about, and we were talking about some egregious mistakes he may have made, the fact that he ran for a fourth term in 1944 when his health was failing, and that seems to be a mistake that you cover pretty thoroughly.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was not that wildly eager to run again, but he saw the mood in the country that if the war was still on, he was confident he'd get reelected. If the war was over, he wouldn't have run again because he understood that he would not have been elected. Sort of the way Churchill in 1945 at the Potsdam Conference was recalled from the conference because the war was over in Europe and the British public was tired of having a wartime president, so to speak, rather wartime prime minister. So Roosevelt, in fact, he said privately that after 1944, his attitude was he wanted to serve only 1 year in a fourth term, by which time he thought the war would be over. And what he would like to do, he said, was resign and head an international peace organization, you see. So he understood that it would be time to get out. But of course, that never happened because he was so ill. And in fact, at the Yalta Conference in February 1945, Winston Churchill's physician, Lord Moran, wrote in his diary, "The president will be dead in 3 months' time. He is suffering from hardening of the arteries of the brain." And of course, he called it right on the mark. Roosevelt died on April 12, 45.
You know, when you're asked, and I'm sure you've been asked a million times, what was it that made Roosevelt great? You know, what made him one of the great presidents? What's your answer?
My answer is that he had a extraordinary feel for the country's democracy with a small d, that he understood how to create consensus, how to command public approval, and how to push the Congress and enact major legislation.
Robert Dalek is the author of a new and masterful biography of our 32nd president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, A Political Life. Robert, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to have been with you.
FDR was idealistic, far from simplistic, opportunistic, highly ambitious, had lofty goals and lots of compassion, knew what he wanted, always demanded, only one who served more than two. Don't break the fresh and world.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our last trivia question, which was, what is the largest city in the country to have elected a lesbian as mayor? The answer is Houston, which in 2009 elected Anise Parker, who is openly gay, as mayor. She was reelected to a 2-year term in 2011 and again in 2013 and left office after 2015 because of term limits. And the randomly selected winner is Andrea Cutter of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Andrea wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttlebutt winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest led off with a button promoting Gloria Schaefer for the Senate in Connecticut. That was followed by an All the Way with LBJ button from 1964. And finally, a very wordy button that read, "I am a left-wing commie anarchist and proud of it." So when you combine Gloria and all and red, you kind of get Gloria Allred, the high-profile women's rights attorney who has been in the news lately defending those who have been sexually harassed or worse by men of prominence. And the winner is Brooks Hilliard of Scottsdale, Arizona. And yes, he's the same Brooks Hilliard who won the scuttlebutt puzzle back in April of 2009. You have some memory. We'll have a new scuttlebutt puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Yeah.
It's time for This Week in Political History. Almost a year to the day of John F. Kennedy's assassination, President Lyndon Johnson won one of the greatest landslides in election history. In office, he pushed through some of the most monumental civil rights and voting rights legislation the country has ever seen. But things were starting to fall apart under LBJ. The war in Vietnam was growing more and more unpopular, with the American death toll rising and demonstrations in the streets increasing. Cities were witnessing riots and destruction over race, and Democrats were starting to fret. But was Johnson, who was up for re-election in 1968, really vulnerable to a primary challenge? 50 years ago this week, Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota decided to find out.
My decision to challenge the president's position and the administration's position has been strengthened by recent announcements out of the administration. The evident intention to escalate and to intensify the war in Vietnam, and on the other hand, the absence of any positive indications or suggestions for a compromise or for a negotiated political settlement. I'm concerned that the administration seems to have set no limit to the price which it's willing to pay for a military victory.
Eugene McCarthy was a strong opponent of the war in Vietnam. He had been hoping, unsuccessfully, that Robert Kennedy would get into the race. When Bobby hesitated, McCarthy got in. During his candidacy announcement, McCarthy was asked about Kennedy and the possibility of him running as well.
Well, I don't know. He might. It would certainly be nothing illegal or contrary to American politics if he or someone else were to take advantage of whatever I might do or what might happen in consequence of what I'm doing. I have no commitment from him to stand aside all the way, and it would certainly be in order for him, and wholly proper, it seems to me, within the rules of American politics, for him to make that kind of move. I would have been glad to have, you know, if he had had him move early. I think if he had, there'd been no need for me to do anything.
Did he really think Johnson could be denied the nomination? Or did he think his candidacy would change the course of the war? Whatever, he was given little chance against Johnson in the New Hampshire primary. But in a stunning result, he finished just 4 percentage points behind the president. A victory of sorts. But that good feeling didn't last long. 4 days later, Bobby Kennedy got into the race. The McCarthy camp felt betrayed. And 2 weeks after that, this happened.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
From then on, with Johnson out of the race, through California, all eyes were on Bobby and Gene. Kennedy won Indiana and Nebraska. McCarthy won Oregon. It was all coming down to California.
Senator Robert F. Kennedy, Democrat of New York, versus Senator Eugene J. McCarthy, Democrat of Minnesota, appearing in their first official confrontation on ABC News Issues and Answers, a special report.
Kennedy won that primary, but his victory was short-lived. His life was taken away by an assassin's bullet. And Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who never entered a single primary, won the nomination. Eugene McCarthy died in 2005. He will always be remembered for his seemingly quixotic challenge to President Johnson. But in his later years, he was very critical of his own party as well. In 1980, he even endorsed Ronald Reagan over President Jimmy Carter. It was 50 years ago this week, on November 30th, 1967, that Senator Eugene McCarthy, a Minnesota Democrat in his second term, announced he would oppose President Lyndon Johnson's renomination bid for 1968. I also want to thank Tim Johnson, the curator at the University of Minnesota Library, for use of the McCarthy campaign announcement audio. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
If you love your country and the things for which it stands, vote for Gene McCarthy and bring peace to this our land.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to Ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Our cities crumble from a bomb dropped on a foreign land. And politicians stand and watch as the flames of hate are fanned.